Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Some people know Sai Khan as an accomplished musician who incorporates his passion for people's rights into his songwriting and performances. His songs of family, community, work, and freedom have been recorded by over 100 artists. But Sai is also an organizer and an author. His new book, The Fox and the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy, is a proclamation about our democracy and the assault on public services such as Social Security, public schools, health care, welfare, army mess halls, and especially prisons. And now our special with Sai Khan.
For many, many, many years, I have listened to the music of Sai Khan, and what a pleasure to not only meet him, but have him here with us to perform to our heart's delight, and we hope yours as well. And not only is Sai a fine songwriter and singer and guitar player, but he's also written a very important book, this wonderful book about privatization. Why did you consider that such a critical issue? Why privatization?
It's actually a multiple person consideration. First, there are the wonderful folks that I work with at Grassroots Leadership. We've been around for 25 years. We do civil rights, community, and labor organizing all over the South. About 10 years ago, we were trying to say, okay, what's the next issue that is really going to threaten all of what we're dealing with? We've been through a tough period of what I tend to think of as the right-wing counter-revolution. And one day, Reverend James Williams, who was a progressive Pentecostal minister on our staff, walked in and said, I've got it. It's privatization. We talked about what privatization means to ordinary people. The word is virtually meaningless. If we actually owe our president for putting the name in the popular mix, because before he tried to privatize Social Security, nobody could pronounce the word. Nobody knew what privatization is. Now people know what it is. But as an issue, it's really central to all kinds of democratic movements. The book is called The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. And it's co-authored with the public philosopher Elizabeth Minnick, who is also my partner and long-term spouse. And Elizabeth has been thinking and writing and speaking about issues of public and private for much longer than I've been organizing around it. So here you have, you know, the organizer, the educator sitting around the table saying, can you believe what they did today? And we felt like, while there's some really fine books out about privatization, they're very focused. They deal with a particular issue. They deal with Amtrak. They deal with charter schools. They deal with water privatization. You know, Vandana Shiva's book on water, on water is fabulous. Eliot Sklar's book sort of on cost analysis, which focuses a lot on transportation. Martha Minow's book on public-private partnerships. There's a lot of those books. But to a large extent, their focus is a strength, but it also means that the broad picture isn't there in quite the same way. And Elizabeth Minnick and I had reached a point where we thought there's a whole different way of thinking about this. We say, forget all this stuff about does it save money? Is it more efficient? Is it more cost effective? Those are smoke screens. Those are essentially corporate lies being thrown at us. Here's what's really going on. That a set of corporations that in the Fox and the Hen House we call the privatizing corporations, poster child, your friendly neighborhood defense contractor, Lockheed Martin, which is also these days running welfare systems, creating policy for the government, policies that they then contract to fulfill. This is why it's the Fox in the Hen House. So we've got these privatizing corporations which have set their sights on the public sector. And then we have some ideologically right-wing and knee-jerk pro-corporate politicians. Our poster child is, of course, none other than George W. Bush, our president, my president, and yours. You know, people who are my corporation, right or wrong. The corporations and the elected officials have basically made a truly radical decision. They've decided that they don't like democratic forms of government and that they no longer need to put up with them. Now, they've never liked the role the government plays in their lives. But they now feel they have the power to actually take over tremendous elements of government and operate it as if it were a private fiefdom, as if it were one of their subordinate corporations, and that what they can't control, they're going to get rid of, they're going to destroy. And privatization is the tool for doing that. So that's why in The Fox and the Hen House, Elizabeth Minnick and I are saying, hey, this is a wake-up call, because these people are moving in on everything that they don't already own, that they want to own it all, and privatization is the tool to get them there.
The left now is on the defensive. The left will say, no, you shouldn't privatize this. No, this particular thing you should not privatize. This should stay in the public sector. Maybe that you can privatize. 100 years ago, the left was saying, this should be in the public sector. We should municipalize. We should have more socialism. But nobody even talks about those words in North America, at least, while in South America right now, they're going in the opposite direction. Let's put it in that kind of context for a second, in the sense of not just going from the negative, we shouldn't privatize things, to what should be in the public sector that's in the private sector now.
That's a good start. Let me.
Oh my goodness! You want to nationalize stuff? Yes.
He wants
I'll
to
take an auto
nationalize
company.
Stuff.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, several things. One, in The Fox and the Hen House, we really tried to lay out a vision of what democracy looks like, not just to say here's what it isn't, but here's what it really is, and here's what the possibilities that are open to us in this historic moment are, if we take advantage of them, if we organize, if we mobilize, if we move forward. So I think that's the first piece of it: is what is our vision of a 21st century democracy? What does it look like? And I think we have to lay that out as a vision from the left before we even begin to talk about what are the specific tactics, what are the specific legislative pieces. So people say, what is it that you people want anyway? Well, I could do the list. I don't think it's that hard to say what people on the left want. We want a country in which no one ever goes to bed hungry. We want a country in which no one is ever homeless. We want a country in which everybody has work, and that work pays enough so that if you decide that you want a family of whatever nature of family that is, that you got enough to support that. We want a country in which nobody's ever denied health care because they don't have money, in which no one is ever denied education because they don't have money. That we want a country where decisions are made as democratically as possible. So I think we actually are capable of laying out a vision. I would add to it, we want to maintain public health. We want to maintain an environment. And that's one of the things I think we should be reclaiming extraordinarily. We should have a new Gulf Coast where the wetlands are restored, both because we need wetlands to nourish our souls, but also because the destruction of the Gulf Coast wetlands was one of the things that allowed this to be a tragedy of such dimensions. So, Ken, I think the first thing is we have to say, what does the whole thing look like? And then we work backwards from there to, therefore, what institutions do we need that enable this vision to be made practical? And which of those are public and which of those are private? But the set of principles has to be there first. We have to say, what are the principles under which something is public rather than private, and what are the principles under which something is private rather than public? That framing things in that way will convince people that there should be a much larger public sector. And then, frankly, the public sector has to deliver in a serious way. We have to figure out where the reason that the public sector isn't delivering is because, for example, it's being deliberately sabotaged and undercut. This is the case, for example, with FEMA. It's the case with many public schools. There's a lot that we can blame on the deliberate right-wing attempt to wreck the public sector so they can prepare it for privatization. But there's some stuff that we frankly can't blame on anybody else. And that's, we have to figure out how, as communities, how as activists, as media people, as attorneys, as voters, as how do we create the kind of momentum that gives us the public sector we deserve.
One of the things about your book, aside from the title, which of course is always fun when you talk about the fox in the hen house, there's an optimism, an affirmative sensitivity that radiates out to people so that many of us can give a very aggressive recitation of the evils of privatization, of globalization, aka imperialism at this juncture. But your book really begins to give a sense of possibility.
And thank you.
I think your last statement did as well. And it's part of your personality and persona as well.
Well,
there's
now,
something
now
very
to be clear
shining
about
it.
Thank you. When the jobs within the progressive movement were handed out, I was assigned the job of being unreasonably happy in the face of disaster. And it's, frankly, it's a dirty, nasty job to get up in the morning and think, oh, God, the world really is going to hell in a handbasket. And I have to go out and be cheerful, but it's my job and I do it as well as I can.
But there's something else there, and that's you're also creative. Now, not every writer is creative. Not every organizer has that artistic soul. You do.
Ooh,
and you meld
you.
Them together. And I'm going to capitalize on that now. By
you're going to what?
Oh, dear. That is not.
Oh, my God.
Thank you for catching
oh, take
me.
Privatize
that.
The whole thing.
Well, Ken, I'm glad you caught me.
I was sort of
one.
Sitting
that was
back
good.
Here watching you two, you know, really play off each other and then
Sort of I use the word like capitalize.
And suddenly cap, all right.
Blow the whole
all
thing.
All right, let's
now it's playoff. Now he's talking about professional sports. We have playoffs. A song.
That, absolutely. My brother is sitting here with a guitar, and I do believe that part of the success of his book has to do with his very creative nature. And I am going to ask you if you can pick something that might be apropos for our audience now.
So what song would you like to hear?
Well, you have a bunch of new songs that you've done. And I was thinking one, I don't recall the name, I just downloaded it. But it has to do with war, young man kind of returning home, and you know which one I mean?
It's probably this one, because this is the song on that CD. The CD is called We're Still Here. Now, I'm not sure whether it's a young man or a young woman. I don't know, and it's not in the song.
Ah,
right,
point well taken.
But, you know, again, if we're talking about how do we popularize the ideas of the left, one is absolutely by separating between the people who make the decisions and the people who fight. And I was in basic training at Fort Jackson in 1937. I was a reservist, so I was relatively protected from having gone to Vietnam. And, you know, I want to be very clear that, you know, I didn't support the war, and there were many of us in the reserves because that was one of the options for hopefully staying out of the war. But the great majority of the people in my company were young African-American men who had been in the rebellions in Huff and in Watts and had been taken before a judge, and the judge had said, well, young man, it's a free country, and I'm going to give you a choice. You're going to do 3 years somewhere. You can do it in prison, or you can do it in the army. Which do you want? And you cannot take out your anger at the policies of our government, at people who are given no other choice, and frankly, even at the people who volunteer, who don't have economic options. You know, also in our company were a lot of white farm kids, Hispanic barrio kids who just had no other options. And I think we have to make a very, very clear separation between those with the responsibility for the policy decisions and those who are actually, in a real sense, defenders of our country. So many times in history, we've watched them march away. Some cry out for victory, some just stand and pray. For this father's daughter, for this mother's son, what will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is over? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? Some are quick to honor, some are quick to blame. Few can face the truth that this all happens in our name. Before the first shot's fired, our battle has begun. What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is over? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? Those who fight the battles are not those who make the laws, but bravery is still bravery, even in an unjust cause. From the hand that signs the order to the hand that fires the gun, what will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is over? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? Some lie solitary beneath a hero's stone. Some return to loved ones, but will always be alone. Something sacred will be lost even when the war is won. What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is over? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is over? What will
happen to the rest of us when the war is done?
Well, I certainly wish the war was done.
But of course, it isn't. And when it is, as we know from Vietnam, at least in our lifetime, it's never quite finished for those who have been forced to bear the brunt of the fighting in response to the policies of those who never go.
Part of what's strange, we were, Elizabeth and I spoke at Demos, which is a progressive think tank. Elizabeth started by saying, this is a quirky book. We set out to write a book that was different. And the book includes not just the sort of political analysis you expect, but it includes song lyrics, it includes poetry, oral history, lots of fables, lots of things taken from other sources that are stories, because that's what people remember. And partly, from my perspective, we needed to give people organizing tools. So a lot of the fables, a lot of the stories are things that in some cases that I'd use in my organizing against privatization, and that we hope people will pick up and remember. So we try to imagine funny situations, the humorous face of privatization, if you will. So here, for example, we imagine two Wall Street Journal reporters who run out of gas in the middle of a firefight in Iraq. And the first reporter says, wow, I think we just ran out of gas. The second reporter, well, of course. You didn't really think Halliburton would deliver all the gas the government contracted for at the low price they bid, did you? Not with a third quarter earnings statement coming up. All of the other military vehicles are leaving us. You can't really expect a major corporation like Halliburton to jump just because some petty government bureaucrat waives the contract they signed at them. They have a responsibility to the bottom line, to their shareholders. If these directors don't manage for a profit, they could be sued for malfeasance. You know that as well as I do. I think we're the only Americans left here. You have to understand the imperatives of the marketplace. Quite possibly, the price of gasoline took a sudden jump on the spot market, and Halliburton was flexible enough to divert these shipments somewhere else. Is that a shoulder-fired missile that guy is aiming at us? So we hope that people will create skits, create fables, and just use it, not necessarily use the particular ones we've created, but to understand the role of theater, the role of poetry.
You organizer, you.
Oh, I know, Well, it is.
But also pointing out how much is contracted out in this war. You were talking at a different stage, I think, about the mess hall that was blown up and how when it was done by the Army, they would have separate mess halls. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about this.
And one of the most wrenching stories in the book. But a lot of folks will remember this happened in Mosul in Iraq. Rockets hit a mess hall. As you said, Ken, a lot of people died. 22 people died in this attack. Right after this happened, Gwen Ifill, on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, interviewed retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters. And this is what he said. What mystified me when I heard about this, Gwen, was that even in maneuvers back in the Cold War days when you were just playing war, you got your chow and you dispersed. Because in war, if an artillery shell hits you, you wanted them to kill two or three or four soldiers at most, not 40 or 50 or 60 or 80. And what's clearly happened in Iraq is we violated our own rules about troop dispersion in wartime. I suspect it has to do with outsourcing. This mess hall was run by a contractor. Still the retired lieutenant colonel speaking. Instead of security, what we saw was convenience and efficiency. But it just baffled me that this base and this chow hall specifically had been attacked before with rocket fire, with mortars, and we were still crowding these troops, not even staggering the schedules. It just astonished me. And then we add, outsourced, contracted out, feeding the troops had been privatized.
When I began reading the book on privatization, I thought about the decimation of the organized labor movement, the inactivity of the rank and file, the lack of democracy and involvement in the decision-making by the workers who toil versus the union bureaucrats who control. And I was wondering about your thoughts as you're putting this book together about the state of the union movement that has not really confronted privatization, although, certainly in places like India, we saw a million plus workers come out over issues such as privatization. But in this country, it hasn't been an agenda item.
I think the labor unions have actually done a very fine job defending against privatization case by case. When a particular workplace is up for privatization, I think the labor movement, at least the unions I'm familiar with, have made a very good fight of it. What I think is missing is understanding that it's not a matter of simply defending against particular fights, that we have to see this as a very broad, very powerful movement on the part of the conservatives. We have to understand that sporadic defensive movements are not going to win. We have to create an aggressive movement that is very long-term, very entrenched, and that brings in unlikely allies. What happens now? The announcement goes up, they're going to privatize our clinic, and everybody fights. And if we win or if we lose, then it's over. Part of the work that I've been involved in with grassroots leadership over these last 10 years is trying to figure out how do we build a sustained movement against privatization in and of itself that is greater than any particular struggle, any particular work site, any particular public surface or public good. That's what I think is missing in this country. People come out, whether it's in Argentina, whether it's in India, when they come out against privatization, they're not saying, don't close this school. They're saying, don't privatize. In the United States, I think one of our weaknesses, it's a weakness of the labor movement, it's a weakness of all other movements. We don't have enough ideology, a fundamental set of beliefs that people agree to, and a fundamental set of tools that we give people with which they can analyze what's happening. And this is the difference I find, for some, even spending time in Canada, that Canadian trade unionists are often much faster to see systems and patterns and to analyze it in more familiar progressive terms, to say, no, this is not just happening to us, this is happening to everybody else. But in the absence of very broad progressive educational agenda, in the absence of any kind of a labor or progressive party, I think it's very hard to do in this country. That's one piece of it. The other piece, where you talk about union democracy, I think unions suffer in the same way as other institutions from a culture of letting everybody do it for you. And this is trained into us by the people in power from birth. We are told, don't worry about it. We're here to take care of it. And for all the rhetoric that we hear on Election Day, we want everybody to get out and vote, that in fact, people in power, whether they are corporations, elected political leaders, they do not want us participating. And they are working as hard as they can to get us out of the participatory processes of politics, because then they are in charge and they call the shots. Recently, Elizabeth Mittick and I were speaking about the fox in the hen house, and somebody said, I'm not a member of an organization. I don't belong to a union. I don't belong to a community organization, but I'm concerned. What can any individual do? You know, we split up the answer. And you know, Elizabeth said, well, the first thing to do is to understand that power in this society, as in any society, is exercised through organizations.
I think the Bolivian workers certainly understood that in their fight against the privatization of water.
Well, exactly. And we'll fight against any privatization. But the only ways that you change a democratic government are with very high levels of participation by people. And we don't have that culture here in this country anymore.
You fired me up. I can't take no more. And that requires another song. And we have not yet looked at a song relevant to the working class labor movement.
I'm going to sing a song that you don't know.
Ah.
And afterwards you will say, that's exactly the kind of song I wanted to hear.
Telepathically.
Evening hangs like smoke on this mill town that I love. My thoughts, they roll and tumble through the years. And my heart drifts through the haze back to Youngstown's better days. The mills have gone away, but we're still here. We're still here. We're still here. The mills have gone away, but we're still here. With our neighbors and our kin, right here where we've always been. The mills have gone away, but we're still here. looking down the street to the days when I was young. I can see my friends and neighbors strong and clear. They came from near and far away, built their lives from day to day. Through the good times and the hard times, we're still here. We're still here. We're still here. The mills have gone away, but we're still here. With our neighbors and our kin, right here where we've always been. The mills have gone away, but we're still here. Dreaming down the days till time circles home, when our children face the future's hopes and fears. Nothing went the way it should, but we did the best we could. When the whistle blows for courage, we're still here. We're still here. We're still here. The mills have gone away, but we're still here. With our neighbors and our kin, right here where we've always been. The mills have gone away, but we're still here.
The pathos, it's tearful. I mean, yeah, we are still here. We endure the working class. But the mills have gone away, Youngstown.
Sometimes I think that's applying to the whole country, not just that particular town.
No, it is. I mean, in writing this, I really wrote it 20 years ago for two wonderful filmmakers who were born and raised in Youngstown. Carol Greenwald and Dory Krause went home and did this film about the mills, and I wrote the soundtrack for it. When it came time to record it, not in a film about Youngstown, I thought, maybe I should make it more generic, but it was about Youngstown. But you're right, Ken. I mean, this is the story of America. It's also the story of many other countries. It's the destruction of jobs. I think it is hard times.
And that's it for the first part of our interview with singer-songwriter and organizer Cy Conn on his new book, The Fox and the Hen House. Tune in next week for part two on Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.